Hey, Prime members, you can listen to this podcast early and ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
Hi, everybody. From Wondery, this is Tides of History. As always, I'm your host, Patrick Wyman. Thanks for joining me. We've got a great guest here today. He's a professor of classics and letters, and he's also the senior vice president and provost at the University of Oklahoma. He's also the author of several books, most recently The Fate of Rome, Climate, Disease, and the End of an Empire, which you can get on Audible or Amazon. I highly, highly recommend it. Kyle Harper, thank you so much for chatting with me today.
Thanks, Patrick. I'm thrilled to do it.
So The Fate of Rome hit me like a ton of bricks. It's eminently sensible. It's totally convincing. And to me, it seems like the key that unlocks a great deal of the uncertainty about the ultimate end of the Roman Empire. Briefly, for the listeners, could you run me through the outlines of the book's argument?
Sure. Thanks, Patrick. The Fate of Rome is an argument that to explain the fall of the Roman Empire, which is this enormous historical process that unfolds in several different phases and has twists and turns. It's not something that happens in a day. And to explain it in full, I think we have to account for the powerful role of the natural environment. And that includes both the physical environment in the form principally of climate change and changes in the biological environment that includes the evolution, the emergence, the arrival of new diseases caused by unfamiliar bacteria and viruses. And these natural forces play a critical role in what is ultimately a human story about the demise of one of the most important political formations in all of pre-modern history.
So I thought that that was a completely convincing argument, and also because around the middle of the 6th century, when all of these forces kind of pick up steam and really reach ahead, that to me, from my work on other kinds of source bases, seems to be like a huge turning point. That after the middle of the 6th century, it seems like trade really drops off. It seems like the population is less. There are fewer sources being produced. People are moving less, is something I noticed from the research that I've done. And it seems like climate and disease really explain, really kind of unlock the larger reasons for those shifts.
I agree. And the 6th century isn't necessarily what we always think of or what's popularly thought of as the fall of Rome, because the Western Empire dissolves in the 5th century and the city of Rome is sacked in 410, or the last Western emperor, Romulus Augustulus, is deposed in 476. Those are kind of milestone dates when people think about the fall of the Roman Empire. But as you know, specialists who work in the field have really developed an ever deeper appreciation for how important the period of Roman history after that is. And in the Eastern Roman Empire, centered on Constantinople or New Rome, which still thinks of itself and really deserves to be considered the Roman Empire, is in a period of renaissance in the 6th century. And it's easy to underestimate really how significant that part of Roman history is. But the empire is flourishing culturally, economically, demographically, even geopolitically. Under Justinian, of course, the Romans are reconquering North Africa and well on their way to reconquering Italy, when all of a sudden, almost literally as a bolt from the sky, nature intervenes. First in the form of what we now understand, thanks to really highly resolved paleoclimate records, to be a series of volcanic eruptions that induce sudden and violent cooling in the climate. And right on the heels of that climate event comes the worst biological catastrophe in magnitude in the history of the human species up to that time, the first pandemic of bubonic plague. The first example of what we might call the first Black Death. The 6th century witnesses an outbreak of the exact same disease caused by the exact same bacterium that causes the much more famous 14th century medieval Black Death. And the Roman Empire is never the same. The Renaissance, the successes of the reign of Justinian are almost immediately reversed. The empire itself begins to fall apart. And over the course of several generations, the empire ultimately not only doesn't recover, but fails even to exist in most of the former territory where it had once held sway.
Yeah, I mean, you raise some really interesting points there, and like the reign of Justinian is a turning point. I mean, that's an argument I'm really amenable to, because if you look at the reign of Theodoric the Great, the Ostrogothic King Theodoric, you look at the documents that are coming out of his court, you look at the material record in terms of the archaeological information that we have, you could be forgiven for thinking that not much, if anything, had really changed if you were looking at that. Then you fast forward 90 years to the time of Pope Gregory the Great at the end of the 6th century, and it's like you're living in an entirely different world.
Exactly. It really is. It's an entirely different world, materially, demographically, culturally, politically. And what strikes me is not just that we can correlate some of these changes to environmental causes like sudden cooling in the climate or the arrival of this new disease, but that if you're zooming out and you're simply looking at the environmental history records, these episodes in the 6th century leap out at you. I mean, in the 530s and 540s, it's not just a kind of ordinary cooling phase. It is the most violent episode of sudden cooling in the entire late Holocene over the last 2,000 or 3,000 years. So just objectively, in terms of the climate records, this is clearly a moment that really jumps out. This isn't just kind of a ho-hum, another downturn. This is something that is wrenching. And so it, I think, adds plausibility for historians to draw a link that's not just correlation, but to a large extent, even causal, to say that the consequences that we see in the human story, the fate of the Roman Empire, is actually, to a large extent, explained by the physical changes that we can trace in these totally independent records, like ice cores, and particularly in the 6th century tree rings.
Kind of to build on that a little bit, like this is one of the things that, like, really stood out to me about your book is just how much it's on the cutting edge of scholarship. I mean, like, the importance of the Justinianic plague has only become clear to us in the last few years. The kind of data that you're talking about with regard to ice cores and tree rings, that is really, really recent stuff. Like, that did not exist when I started graduate school a decade ago, you know? I mean, so how has our knowledge of these things changed? I mean, is this a book that you could only be writing in 2015, 2016, 2017?
I absolutely think that this isn't a book that could have been written 5 years ago. And the bad news is that it'll be out of date in 4 or 5 years. But that's also the good news, because we're learning so much so fast. And I thought it was a good time to try and summarize what we've learned and what historians can say that we couldn't say before. And the paleoclimate evidence has been mounting for 20 years. And just in the last few years, though, we've come to have a much clearer resolution of our focus of what the Roman climate was like. And I think the next few years promise even greater insights. But the level of information, the mountains of information that we're getting from genomic data is what's really moving fast. And as you rightly say, even down to a few years ago, the Justinian plague was sort of befuddling, because the written records seemed to emphasize its importance, but it was impossible to say with certainty what caused it. And that makes it hard to really know how bad was it. And there are giant dark areas of our knowledge where we just don't even know if the plague spread that far. So once we then have genomic evidence that is very convincing, that says this is precisely the agent of this pandemic, it lets us connect the microbiology of the germ and how it sits on the evolutionary history of this extraordinary bacterium. It also lets us find evidence from places where we thought we would never know if the plague had reached. One of the really big questions for historians was, how bad was the Justinianic plague? And we could easily believe that it was terrible in Constantinople. That's where our written sources are looking. That's what they're describing, is its devastation in the capital. But now we have physical evidence for the plague in the form of its genome, discovered from what amount to really small villages in southern Germany. And the fact that the plague has been found there in the 6th century is of just enormous consequence. It tells us the answer to one of the most important questions that historians had been asking. And it's just something that we didn't know a few years ago, and it changes the entire picture.
Yeah, it's hard to overstate, in comparison to the Black Death of the 14th century, how few written sources we have for the Justinianic Plague. I mean, it's nowhere close to being the same volume of information. Like, you can track the spread of the plague in the 14th century day by day, week by week, village to village. You can track it in very great detail, and scholars have. With the Justinianic Plague, we don't have nearly the kind of information that would allow us to do something like that. But as you point out, we're getting the kinds of information that now from other bodies of evidence, from genomes, from mass graves, to be able to say a lot more about it, right?
Exactly. The amount of written evidence that we have for the Justinianic Plague is minuscule in comparison to what we have for the 14th century Black Death. Now, at the same time, the eyewitness accounts of the Justinianic Plague that we have, while they're very few in number, they're amazing. They're rich. They're just unsettling. They're remarkable testimonies. I think of Procopius and John of Ephesus in particular. But when you compare what we have for the 6th century to the 14th century, it's orders of magnitude smaller. And so the genomic evidence helps fill in pictures where we have a level of just basic ignorance about what happened. That's not the case in the 14th century, where we have a much richer literary and documentary record. Now, the genomic evidence of the sort that I'm talking about for the Justinianic Plague has also been found for the Black Death. And in fact, that the picture of the Black Death is becoming richer in parallel for exactly these same kinds of reasons. And the ability to combine the traditional source material that historians use, like historical documents, with this new kind of evidence, archaeological DNA, is creating this amazingly rich picture of the Black Death. And that actually matters a lot for historians who are interested in late antiquity, because now that we know with certainty that these two just world-changing pandemics were caused by the same germ, we can pursue kind of comparative analysis. And while we can't just assume that the Justinianic Plague was exactly like the Black Death, we can hypothesize and we can fill in the picture cautiously with our greater understanding of the medieval Black Death.
Yeah, well, with a larger sample of human remains to work from, you can talk about the extent to which population health, like broader population health, plays a role in the virulence of the plague. Like, were these populations healthy or sick to start with? And does that make populations more vulnerable to a pandemic?
Yeah, those are exactly the kinds of questions that are being asked right now of the medieval Black Death. And I'm hopeful that some of those can actually be asked of the Justinianic Plague as we retrieve more genomes from the 6th century, and that's happening as we speak. I think we can ask questions about, you know, what was the health status of the populations when the plague struck? Or what is the relationship between different, what are sometimes called waves of the plague? Because one of the insidious facts about bubonic plague, in both the case of the first pandemic that I talk about and the second pandemic that begins with the Black Death, is it isn't just a one-off. The plague explodes in a pandemic event in an initial wave, but then it recurs every 10 years, 15 years over the course of the next two centuries. And so in the first pandemic, we're really talking about not just the first wave that occurred in the 541 to 543, but we're talking about two centuries of events where the plague will flare up and strike again. And the archaeological genomes are going to be very important for helping us understand, how did the plague recur like that? Was it the same line, or was it reintroduced from without? Did it mutate? Did it its genome change in significant ways, and so on? So there's so many questions that we're going to be able to answer in 5 years that we can't answer today.
If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Yeah, that's a big one to bear in mind, because if we're talking about there being a demographic transition that goes along with the end of the Roman Empire, even the Roman world, if you want to put it in those terms, this drastically decreased population is a big part of that. And it's not just like, normally what happens after a wave of disease is the population rebounds fairly quickly, even if there's mass mortality. That doesn't happen with these outbreaks of bubonic plague. Like, the population in Europe after the Black Death doesn't really start to rebound until for 120, 150 years afterwards, depending on exactly where you're looking. So the fact after the Justinianic Plague, if this drastically decreased population is one of the hallmarks of a shift to a new era, that recurrence of plague is a big reason why. Is that correct?
Exactly. I think that there was probably something like two centuries of relative demographic stagnation. And as you say, these ancient societies are resilient. And, you know, even in the absence of these giant pandemic disease events, they live in an unhealthy environment, and life expectancy is low, and they always have to endure and find ways to survive amidst very challenging health environments. And the pandemic events like the plague are just a challenge on a much bigger scale. And they try and pick up and rebound. But the magnitude of these events is so enormous that the rebound is relatively slow in comparison with the shock of mortality that can unravel over the course of a year or two in these plague events. And then just when the society is maybe starting to recover a little bit, to experience another wave or another outbreak of the plague makes it that much harder for the society to recover from the first shock. So it's not just the initial wave, but it's that that chain explosion over the course of two centuries that helps depress the population over such a long period of time.
So shifting gears just a little bit, I mean, there's a lot that I love about this book, but my favorite piece is that it's predicated on the idea of a Roman Empire and a Roman world that's bound together by movement, by the movement of goods and the movement of people. So how does that kind of world create the circumstances for disease to spread? And how is a world like that vulnerable to climatic shifts?
Well, the version of the Roman Empire that I try and describe is one in which the Romans achieve a certain amount of development, of social and economic development, that I think is significant. And I don't think that pre-modern development down to the Industrial Revolution is simply kind of one flat line around subsistence. I think there are waves of growth and complexity and development, and then there are waves of regression and disintegration. And the Roman Empire is this huge wave of development, and it's not built on fossil fuels, but it's built first and foremost on trade, on commercial exchange. And that means both internally inside the empire, where trade flourishes and permits the development of urbanization, exchange between cities, exchange between the city and the countryside. And it includes trade externally. The Romans are trading with peoples beyond their frontiers, across every frontier, the Sahara, the Red Sea and Indian Ocean, the Near East, the northern frontiers. And so the Roman Empire is a world of development, and that development is built on exchange, movement, the commerce of people and commodities and ideas and, of course, germs. the movement across borders, the movement within the empire, facilitates the transmission of microscopic pathogens that the Romans are transmitting or carrying further and faster than had ever been possible before. So the movement of germs is a part of a wider pattern of movement and exchange that is really integral to what the Roman Empire is.
Yeah, this is something that I've really tried to emphasize over the course of doing my podcast, is that the Roman world has to be understood as a place where goods and people moved, where, like, you could bring together, that you could find pottery from North Africa in Britain, that you could find goods imported from India in Spain or in Gaul, that, like, this was the baseline thing that tied the whole Roman Empire together, was this constant movement. And so that's a source of strength. But something like that is also vulnerable to climatic shifts, right?
It's a vulnerability insofar as the Roman Empire, I don't think, implodes of its own overreach. Mm-hmm. I really do think it's important that the Roman Empire is sort of struck from without by these exogenous shocks to the system. It's not a Malthusian meltdown where the growth and development of the Roman economy overreaches its inherent limits or capacity. But the very fact that the Romans have built this highly complex system that depends on so many internally intricate parts does make it vulnerable. And so when it falls apart, it falls really hard, and it causes really deep structural changes in the basic way of life and what people consume and how they live and who they interact with. And so I think that the development of the Roman Empire is important as a factor of, as you put it, vulnerability. It's a fragile system that ultimately succumbs to these really massive exogenous shocks.
So something that I want to follow up with there is, you talk a lot about resilience, about the Roman Empire as a pretty resilient society, that it responds to shocks in the 2nd century, in the 3rd century, some in the 4th century, before finally kind of succumbing over time. So what was it that made the Roman Empire so resilient as it weathered shock after shock after shock?
Right. I try to emphasize in particular the resilience of Roman society and the Roman economy in the face of climatic turbulence, because that's something that the Romans are able to deal with. By its very nature, life in the Mediterranean requires this, and there's a kind of ancient or organic, I mean, it's almost in the soil that any society that's going to grow up in the Mediterranean has to be resilient. It has to be prepared for really unpredictable variability between years. There are going to be good years and there are going to be bad years. And so societies develop from the ground up. They develop ways to cope with really strong fluctuations. And they know how to store food. They know how to grow emergency crops. They know how to scavenge forests in times of real dearth. And so there's a kind of inherent resilience in these societies around the Mediterranean. And the Romans, on top of that, imposed the power of empire in ways that also facilitates the ability of these societies to withstand shock. And so we know that the climate will sometimes be really favorable in one part of the Roman Empire in a year when it's maybe less favorable in another. And by its very nature, the Roman Empire can absorb stress from the climate by, say, taking grain surpluses from one part of the empire and shipping them to another part. And we know that the Roman emperors do this all the time. In fact, it's conceived in some sense as part of their role, is to kind of impose this system of resilience around the empire as a whole. So in the face of climate challenge, the Romans are pretty resilient. That doesn't mean that they can easily withstand really severe climate shocks or really repeated climate shocks. I mean, one bad year is something the Romans can handle. Two, three bad years in a row can be a much more profound challenge. But I, on the flip side, would argue that the ancient societies like those of the Roman Empire really struggle in the face of demographic shocks. And even though there's always a background of a very heavy disease burden. As I mentioned, life expectancy is low and life is hard. And to respond to that, ancient societies have very high fertility rates. And so it's really the only answer in that kind of society to high mortality is to have very high fertility. That means that women have to marry very young. They have to have lots of children. They have to get remarried if their husband dies in order for the population to replace itself. And simply to sustain itself at the same level, given its mortality rates, the average Roman woman surviving to menopause probably had to bear over six children. And so to experience demographic growth or to rebound from sudden mortality crisis like a plague is actually really hard. And so when you combine that kind of shock with other challenges, say geopolitical challenges like new enemies across the frontier, it really is a struggle for the empire to endure that kind of shock. When you throw in climate shock, demographic shock, and geopolitical challenge, it's a recipe for disaster.
What you just said right there, the combination of different shocks, to me, helps to explain why the crisis of the third century, which is something that I've talked about on this show before, why the crisis of the third century was such an actual crisis. Because you have plague, you have a climate that's changing quite a bit in a pretty limited span of time, combined with political difficulties all at once. All three of those things were going on more or less simultaneously.
Do you ever feel like you're settling? For your foundation, that is. Maybelline's new Instant Age Rewind Eraser Foundation doesn't settle into fine lines and wrinkles. With SPF 20 and moisturizing Pro Vitamin B5, this foundation not only provides medium coverage and a natural finish, but also protects and nourishes your skin. And the best part? The blurring sponge tip applicator makes application a breeze. Say goodbye to cakey, uneven foundation, and hello to a flawless, radiant complexion. Try our new foundation today and see the difference for yourself at amazon.com/instant-eraser-foundation.
Audible is the destination for thrilling audio entertainment with highly anticipated new releases. The time is now more than ever to embrace the breathtaking, sinister, and shocking tales that can enthrall you, especially with brand new exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors who are guaranteed to keep you gripped, like Amy Tintera's Listen for the Lie. With exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors, captivating sound design, and dynamic performances, Audible brings these stories to life like never before. And as a member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
Right. And I don't think we should underestimate how important that crisis is in the big picture of Roman history. It really is the first fall of the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire more or less falls apart. And I think what's actually more surprising is that it ever really recovers. I mean, a lot of empires face this kind of challenge and begin to fragment and don't ever really recover in the same terms. And it's amazing that a series of emperors who are very, very different from the old emperors are able to restore the Roman Empire. And they do it under the banner, ideological banner, of restoration. Even though they are not like the early Roman emperors, most of whom were wealthy Mediterranean senatorial elites, these are hard, real military men. They're generals who've served in the ranks. They all come from the Danubian frontier. They're a very different kind of person than the early Roman emperors. But they do manage to put it back together. And even though there's profound change, the money system has to be completely renovated. There's profound religious change as Christianity begins to spread like wildfire. They do actually piece back together in political terms the Roman Empire. But the depth of that crisis is not to be underestimated. And it seems to me that it definitely has geopolitical causes. It has structural, social, political causes. But it looks like it has a really strong trigger in a series of devastating droughts, and then in particular, a new kind of plague that erupts around 249 and again strikes across the entire empire and seems to be responsible for sending the empire into the depths of this crisis.
The way in which all those different factors play together is really, really fascinating to me because you have a series of political crises that had been ongoing for quite some time. None of them in themselves necessarily fatal. But then you have a drastic plague, which kills a great many people, kills a lot of the soldiers guarding the empire's borders, which plays into the political crisis by putting those soldiers on edge and making them more likely to rebel and proclaim their general emperor, which opens up opportunities for barbarians to raid across the frontier, which further devastates an already devastated economy, and so on and so forth, in a vicious cycle that lasts for the better part of two decades.
Right. And I think that's what historians can really contribute to the bigger need to understand how human and natural systems are related. You know, there's been a series of very good papers published in the last 4 or 5 years that are published in scientific journals like Nature, and that show like the tree ring records that help put into perspective the magnitude of the climate shock. And they'll have the line charts that show the reconstructed temperature changes. And then they'll have little labels that match some of the high points and low points of, say, climate change. And they'll say, this is when the crisis of the third century happened, or this is when the barbarian invasions were, or this is when the Persian wars were. And, you know, they're just correlations. They just show the relationship between a climate fact and a human fact. And I think that's one thing that historians need to build on, but it's what history adds, is to tell the whole story. And the whole story is complex, and it's contingent and unpredictable. And it involves human beings, human choice. And that doesn't mean that one way of explaining the past is better than the other. It's that we need both. We need to understand in as much detail as we can the physical record of things like the climate, as well as the human record of things like the Roman Empire. And the ability to interweave those stories is what I think history can uniquely contribute.
Well, that gets at exactly something that I wanted to ask you about, which is, how do we avoid environmental determinism here? How do we avoid saying that, you know, the one thing, the change in the noticeable shift in the climate record at the middle of the third century or in the 530s, how do we avoid taking each of those as the direct cause and try to come to a more nuanced understanding of how these various factors play together?
Well, it's a legitimate concern. And I the way I think of it is that I try to avoid being reductionist. Mm-hmm. And I think reductionism is a sin for anyone who's trying to explain something. And that means that we don't have the right number of variables in whatever problem we're trying to explain. But I'm a little bit of a determinist insofar as I do think it's important not to be afraid to say sometimes there are causal links between a physical or biological cause and a human or social consequence. But usually the kinds of problems that we're interested in explaining, like the fall of the Roman Empire or the failure of a particular state, does require us to have, not in order not to be reductionist, to have enough sense of both the natural variables and the human variables. And a satisfying answer is going to require an adequate account of both how the environment played a role, including a determining role, and how human structures played a role. And there's, you know, there are times when maybe one is a more important force than the other. And in the book, I do think that the fall of the Western Roman Empire is an example where human factors play an enormous role, and probably in some ways even more important than natural causes. Whereas I think the events of the 6th century, like the onset of this little ice age and the arrival of bubonic plague, are an example in history when the power of natural forces is so overwhelming that we shouldn't be shy about attributing an enormous amount of causal agency to the environment.
Yeah, I mean, I think at that point, it may be helpful to distinguish between the fall of the Roman Empire and the end of something like a Roman world, or a world that was defined by things like that free and easy movement of goods and people across a really wide stretch. Because this was not necessarily a counterargument, but something that came to mind as I was reading this was that the first half of the 5th century, the climate is really pretty good, right? The end of the 4th century, the beginning of the 5th century, as the Roman Empire is starting to fall apart politically, its political structures are kind of creaking and grinding. You have a series of child emperors that are either feckless or useless, and the rise of kind of court culture in terms of political decision-making at the center, barbarians nibbling at the edges and of the empire, that at that point, there is no clear causation, like link with a climate mechanism or a disease mechanism. It's just these things seem to be falling apart more or less of their own accord.
I think that's right. Yeah, I would agree with that.
So kind of shifting gears a little bit, one more question I have to ask you. As a specialist on this period, do you think the Roman Empire fell?
I'm in the camp that says yes. I think we can recognize, if we mean that politically, that there is a political entity that continues beyond the early 7th century and considers itself the Roman Empire. But I still think we can objectively say that the state that calls itself the Roman Empire from around the middle of the 7th century onward is qualitatively different than the empire that had preceded it. It has a different administrative system. It clearly has a radically different territorial scope. I think we can call it the Byzantine Empire or not, but I'm very comfortable with saying that politically, anything worthy of the name Roman Empire has come to an end by the early 7th century. But when we talk about the fall of the Roman Empire, I think I would want to cast it as something more than just a political story. It's a social and economic transition as well. And it goes back to what I was saying about pre-modern history has these waves of growth and development, and then it has periods of recession and disintegration, loss of complexity. And that's not a moral judgment. It's not an aesthetic judgment. I personally find the 6th and 7th centuries to be extremely interesting periods culturally, and they're important. They matter in the big picture of the human story. These are some of the most creative periods of Christian history, certainly of Islamic history. So it's not a moral or aesthetic judgment to say that in socioeconomic terms, the Roman Empire fell apart. It's a material judgment that there was a loss of complexity, there was demographic stagnation, there was a disintegration that I think is worthy of this, you know, simplifying name, the fall of the Roman Empire. The Roman system, as it was at the height of the Roman Empire in the 2nd century, as a demographic system, as an economic system, urbanization, trade, all of these things that made the Roman Empire what it was at its height, are very, very different by, say, 600 or 650. And when I say the fall of the Roman Empire, that's what I'm talking about.
That makes a ton of sense. And I mean, it feels like the direction of momentum has kind of shifted, because there was a whole generation of historians who would have been very reluctant to say more or less what you just said. And I feel like the ability to come to terms with the material evidence, with the increasing amount of material evidence we have, whether it's of climate, of disease, of just the sheer amount of stuff that we can find. I mean, like there's a great quote that you use in your book from the archaeologist Neil Christie, where he says, people are just so much harder to find on the ground in Italy after about 550. And I think the fact that we can make that judgment now, when we couldn't maybe a generation ago, that feels like the root of this shift in outlook.
Right. And obviously, there was circumstances were different 30, 40 years ago, when you still had a conception of late antiquity as a period of decline. And that was meant – far too comprehensively, not just decline in terms of population or economic development, but decline in the sense of inferior to the golden age or the classical period. And so the creation of late antiquity as a period of study worthy of study in its own right, as its own cultural expression that shouldn't be judged by relatively arbitrary standards of what was the golden age or classical age of antiquity, you know, that was necessary. And it opened up the field of late antiquity that has been such an extraordinarily creative and interesting period to study over the last generation. I think now there can be a little bit of a rapprochement between the kind of more negative view of the period that I think has some basis in the qualified senses that I've been defending, with the more sympathetic view that was an intervention against a judgmental age of historiography that existed before the important work of developing the field of late antiquity.
Yeah, it's the difference between making a value judgment about the relative importance or quality of two periods and one that rests on the material evidence at your disposal.
I think that's it.
Well, so on that note, thank you so much for joining me here today. It was an absolute pleasure to talk with you. To all of the listeners, I highly recommend The Fate of Rome. I think it will change the way that you think about this period and change the way you think about history in general, too. So thank you very much for joining me.
Thanks so much.
Let's jump into Peppa's world of play. Look for spring flowers, hunt for muddy puddles, and bravely explore exciting places with Peppa play sets. Peppa Pig. Inspiring kid confidence.